Welcome to the Practice Podcast. Conversation
well, folks, I've loved every conversation.
I'm your host, Dave Fearon,
hosting 254 of them
of the digital book
over the last several
practice
years.
Practice is a way of being.
This one,
find it
with
mylibrary.world.
He
now
in
to our show.
Amsterdam and I here in Connecticut was one I just didn't want to have end. I wanted to keep it going. Every turn of subject, his perspective, his experience, and his point of view just kindled still another angle, another question that I wanted to pursue. And I had to turn it off at a certain point because your patience as a listener is just something I count on. However, let me point out that when we started, to ask him just before the recording, what is it you want me to say about you to introduce you? And he said, well, I'm a seeker. I'm a searcher. Now, he is a researcher. He teaches, but he's an action researcher. He's attracted to where people put their best selves together and create transformation. He's also intrigued with the question of silence. And how does silence fit into our lives? Yeah, I know. Silence. We don't get a lot of that these days, do we? But he'll talk about that. And so many other things. I just am bubbling with enthusiasm for another chance to talk to Frake Sandes as he pursues his PhD and goes on. Oh, and by the way, he didn't say this on the mic, but I just learned that they're going to have their first child very soon. So there's another adventure for this fine young scholar. Well, I am on a journey and have been now, as you may know, if you're following this series, for 4 years, I've been pursuing a question, practice with a question mark. And every time I find someone who's intriguing, which is pretty easy to find in this world, I want to know more about that person and what that means to me. Because, you know, it's not all about me, but this is what a conversation is all about. So through a good friend, Carol Gorlick, I discovered her enthusiasm for Frake Sandes, whom she met at a conference of people interested in action research. She said, you must have Frake on your podcast. And here I am, Carol, if you're out there, we're having this conversation. I asked how he'd like to be introduced, and I was intrigued by one word, which we'll probably develop, and that is, I'm a seeker. I search. So let me start out by asking you, have you always been a seeker, Frake?
Oh, have I always been one? Yeah, well, I think so, because I think when I was a little kid, I also liked to explore. I remember my father taking me to the library on Saturdays. He normally went upstairs to read the newspaper. And he let me just run around and explore all those marvelous walls filled with books. And I think there maybe my seeking talent or my desire to seek was kind of, you know, nurtured. Yes. So I think I've always been looking for information, for insights, for new things. So, yes.
Well,
I think it started early on in my life.
I love the idea that your memory is of the reading area of a library. Some of us growing up, that was one of our happiest moments when we could step into a library. You probably, like I, can remember the kind of the smell of it. It's sort of a nice dusty smell, very quiet, and the temperature seemed to be a little warmer than normal. But boy, getting your hands, pulling a book out, opening up, getting a look at what it is about, is a tremendous tactile experience, which you've probably never let go of, because folks, I can see it in Freak's background, there's a lot of books there. So we can look at any subject in a library, but over the time, have you been gravitating toward one particular zone of inquiry that keeps you going right to this moment?
Well, I could say silence, which is in a way true, but I think it's the ways of working of humans, their mind, and more recently also their body. So I think it's, how we as humans behave. I have the book Behave by Sapolsky here. I've not read it entirely, but I've read parts of it. So I think it's I studied economics, which is also about the behavior of people. I now teach at the University of Applied Sciences in the area of applied psychology, which is about human behavior. So in a way, I think it's about how we humans behave, how we think, how we act, what we do, what we not do. I think that's what intrigues me.
There's plenty of subject matter there.
You can fill many libraries with that.
Absolutely. And I wonder if you've shared with me the opportunity to learn about human behavior through fiction, by reading fiction. And in my case, I wrote some fiction. But what it showed me about fiction is that by being keen observers of human behavior in various settings and eras and so forth, the human mind can actually conjure up a whole society. It's incredible. Or at least a small town or something, or a company where they're populating it with what we call characters. But in a way, there's some transference to actual observing real people in real time. Am I imposing fiction on you? Or do you read some fiction?
Oh, I definitely read fiction. I love it. I've been reading it a little bit too little, but I started again recently with fiction. And you refer to that fiction is filled with the society of people. And actually, which is very interesting, I am kind of using a theory that is called the dialogical self theory, which says as human beings have a society, kinds of I persons, all the people that met in our lives.
So there was a break in the signal, and Frank very kindly moved down to where his Wi-Fi is stronger there in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and interrupted his lovely wife, who is probably relaxing, and now she's got to step out of the way for our podcast. But isn't that what's wonderful about Zoom? We get into each other's homes. Yes. And under each other's skin a little bit, but it's saved my sanity over the last 4 years to have Zoom, particularly during our shutdown here in the States. But let's go back to, we talked about fiction and,
yes,
and how that's instrumental in your being a seeker. So then you were about to talk about, was it dialogical?
Yes, the dialogical self theory, because you said that books were populated with characters.
Yes.
And actually, the dialogical self theory also says that our mind is a kind of a society of all kinds of what is called I positions, so different points of view. And it's also populated actually by the people that we've met in the past in a certain way, of course, not literally, but in a way people live on in our mind. So it's really a society of the mind.
I love it. And in dialogue itself, in writing any kind of a fiction, is that we put words in people's mouths.
Yes.
And it's literally, and John says, and Mary listens and replies. But it's, to me, in regard to being observers and seekers of the nature of human behavior, watching interaction, what my son Dave calls turns of talk, in understanding how people enact a social situation with each other or for each other is pretty basic, but on the other hand, it's barely explored from my standpoint. So your research and the other thing I want to mention, it sounds like you're freer. Drake is freer in how you want to go about learning things. And by that, I mean that maybe it's more about the way higher ed has worked in the States. In order for someone to get published, they've had to become very narrow, data-driven, evidence-based, all of that, to get something published in order to stay employed, which is, I'm exaggerating to make the point. But I was raised in the liberal arts tradition, and I'm seeing nowadays a lot more reason why we need to open up the apertures, if we will, of our learning nature and make these connections between biology and poetry and music and all of those things. Why? Because all of that gives us more clues about humans behaving in organizations. And that one thing Carol told me about the group she met with you guys, you're in the middle of the action. You want to see it, the circumference, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me more about your way of looking at that phenomenon.
Yeah, that's a daunting question.
Oh, and by the way, we only got 10 minutes now. I threw that out, but I think that has pretty much a lot to say about where the future is going to be and in the kind of investigating you do. And my point is, I'm pandering to say I want lots of eclectic learning going on to people trying to understand human behavior.
Yeah, and I think that's I mean, multiple viewpoints and multiple perspectives and using also different methods, be it quantitative, qualitative, or action research, and poetry and art. I think that's the way to go forward. And I've always, I think throughout my career, strived for multidisciplinarity. And I remember when I was a student, in 1992, I was a member of the faculty council, so as a student representative, and they started to introduce what we called the AAP principle. It was an afrekening of afspraak. It meant that you needed to deliver as an academic. Mm. And some of the faculty that was part of the faculty council said, "But hey, I'm in a multidisciplinary field. The journals that I publish in are much lower ranked. So, you know, this causes a lot of difficulty in how to, you know, value things." And I remember that because this was in 1992. That's a long time ago. But as a student, I thought, oh, so if you're monodisciplinary, you get higher value journals, apparently. And that's apparently appreciated more. Yeah. But I think it's very good to have a very narrow focus. And at the same time, we need a broad focus, I think, to really understand phenomena and to look at it from different perspectives and from different schools of thought and even maybe from different worldviews.
Yeah, I think your observations was similar to what Peter Vail and I were concerned about here in the States, about that the publishing requirement kind of squeezing people into a box. With the idea that, okay, once I'm tenured, I can now fly about the cabin. You know, no, you can't, because by then your affiliations tend to be so structured and, you know, only certain conferences for your papers. So action research seems to be one of the places where you have the latitude and the encouragement to get into a situational view of what's going on with problem solving as an aspect of it. But then the conversations are very rich, aren't they, among the people who share that interest in that particular action?
Yes, absolutely. I remember indeed you referenced to Carol, and I met her during an action research meeting in a retreat in November in Italy. And I met people I'd never seen before, but we shared this interest in action research for transformation. And the conversations we held were immediately so deep and impactful, and also using different methods to also get into a conversation. Also, the embodied wisdom. So we also had kind of an exercise where we kind of embodied a certain viewpoint with our body and then transform it and then talk about it. And that was a wonderful method to see what kind of wisdom is in the body. And yeah, that gives very rich, very inspiring conversations.
Yeah. Well, that's where we've got to be going. I'll throw in one more wrinkle. A couple of the folks I've had recent podcast conversations with were moving into a keen interest in artificial intelligence and how that was going to impact, you know, their work and the work of all of our lives. And I'm old-fashioned because in all cases, I keep underlining the word artificial. And put the question around intelligence. However, I have done a bit of learning since then, and I realized that the attempt to model and in some ways mock human intelligence through these software applications is with us and will remain with us. But what I wonder about is if they'll ever come out with something that like wisdom. It'll dig a huge, unbelievably vast database to come up with a string of words. But what do you think about what you experienced in that one moment, for example, of the exercise to bring about the body wisdom? Are we going to see that in artificial intelligence?
Well, no, maybe a couple of years or decades down the road when the artificial intelligence can be incorporated into an artificial body.
It's coming.
But I think I talked about it this morning with my supervisor, Professor Rens van Loon, who is also with Emeritaat. So he retired a year ago, but he's still very active, like you. And we talked about this because we talked about also whether the chat GPT, for example, would have different eye positions, different viewpoints. And Rens actually had a conversation with chat GPT and asked chat GPT for about that. But the answer was that the system doesn't have personal experiences. So It could never, you know, incorporate that personal experience as a part of a wisdom carrier to create kind of a holistic viewpoint of wisdom. It can analyze very strongly, although it's also sometimes very stupid. If you ask a simple question, sometimes you get the stupidest answer. But that's also what some wise people do. I think sometimes you ask a wise question and then you get an answer. You think, what does this mean?
Yeah.
But so the AI knows things in between quotation marks based on, say, the algorithm and the information that was introduced there. So can it generate something truly new? That I don't know. That's a good question. It also goes back, I think, to the old philosophers who talked about, is everything always as it is? Or is everything in constant flux? Yeah. So I think the questions that you pose about AI are kind of also going back to, the old, in this case, the Greek philosophers.
Yeah. Well, I think that notion that it doesn't know experience is really something revolutionary to my thinking, because the field that I've gravitated into, organizational behavior here in the States, with Peter Vail as one of the early students with the folks at Harvard about organizational behavior, organizational development. Mm-hmm. It's experience is the most prominent aspect of our study, writing, teaching, and ways of teaching to develop humans' experience, develop peak experiences or challenging experiences, and then counting on people learning at the point of action and efficacy at the point of action. That, it, I, you know, to me, that's the little bit of a contest that I like to say, that human intelligence, we can do far more with our own experience and getting into the experience of others collectively to solve problems so far. And being a teacher of undergraduates my whole career, I was always saying, you're going to learn by your wits out there. You know, the thing you know today will not be pertinent tomorrow. So you're going to be a constant learner. Peter called him a superb learner. And then from there, you're still going to have a lot of struggles. But this is about you, not about me. So, I want to know a little bit about your interest in silence, since I'm not very good at producing it. I think that's something you're investigating, silence.
Yes, yes. Well, I remember that I was on a business trip in somewhere 2001, and I went to London, and on business trips, I always try to do also some art. So I went to the National Gallery in London, and there I saw a painting by Salvatore Rosa, which is an Italian painter, I think 16th century or 17th century, and he had painted a very large portrait of a philosopher, and that philosopher was holding in his hand a kind of a tablet, so not an iPad or but a tablet like a plate, and that had a quote on it, and I cannot reproduce it in Latin, but it can be translated as, say nothing unless what you have to say is better than silence. And I was utterly moved by that.
It's interesting.
It stayed with me for a long time, and it kind of also inhibited me in a way to speak, because I was always thinking, is what I have to say better than silence?
Well, what is for there? Our podcast, it's definitely better than silence.
Yes.
But there's a question there that's really, really intriguing, because it's really, for me, it's asking, how much am I thinking now of what you're going to say next or what I'm going to say next versus just letting us soak each other in and just have that experience of each other and maybe even relishing a bit of silence while we're seeing what comes up in the way of the next thought rather than rushing on, which maybe is more, I don't know, maybe it's a more of an American trait than it is in Scandinavia, but boy, do we talk fast over here. Have you noticed trying to keep your English and your and your Dutch going at the same time when you're in conversation with us Americans? Or
well,
the English?
I think the Americans they think fast, and they think also in a way business-like, very clearly. So I admire a lot of, you know, things that come from the United States, and also do the power of the language. But yeah, I think the US is also a bit of a country with maybe a bit of a rush. But we've also started to be more rushed in the Netherlands. I think they have done studies even that people started to walk faster on the pavement. I don't know whether it was in the Netherlands, but I think it's probably a global thing that we have increased the need for speed. You see it, of course, with all kinds of digital tools.
Yeah.
You know, in the old days, they wrote letters. I mean, email is not that different from writing a letter, but in the old days, it took a couple of days before you received it, especially when you were living abroad. because the mail in the Netherlands also arrived four times a day or five times a day at a certain moment. So there was fast communication. But yes, I think sometimes, and that I think is also what silence offers us, is the opportunity to slow down and to kind of be with our thoughts, be with our conversational partner, either your internal conversational partner or the person that you're talking with. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed talking about this topic is a huge interest from people and a bit of a desire, a longing for more silence in their lives.
You're right on that one. In fact, I think that's what Carol and I talked about when she came back from that trip, and she said, "Oh, and I've met Drake, and he's interested in silence." And she said, "You know, all the way back on the plane, I was thinking, should I talk to anyone, or should I just relish the fact that I'm not having to say a word, and it's acceptable?" Because it is, you know, if you can look at our culture, maybe unfortunately it may be spreading your way. It's highly acceptable to be silent in a social moment. People like, "Cat, get your tongue." That's one of the phrases we up in Maine had when I was a kid. "Oh, the cat got your tongue," meaning, "Why are you so quiet? Don't you have anything to say?" But I thought that the sense that there's a yearning to have more peace of mind, moments of peace of mind, is something I pick up a lot now that I'm on a number of different webinars, not as a presenter as much as an appreciative viewer. And we had one yesterday from the Organization Development Network focusing on human-centered organizations. So I thought, that's an interesting topic, but aren't they all human-centered? I mean, what's an organization without humans? But the point that she was making, I'm sorry, I can't think of her name. Terrible that way. I'm 81, so I can excuse not knowing names. But the point was that the very beginning, there's only an hour and maybe 20 people. She said, "Well, before I start talking, could we just have a moment of reflection, silence? We're not going to do any mantras or anything, just breathe." Mm-hmm. And she's been an organization developer for a long time, and that's something we do. But maybe that's something along the lines of what you're studying. What project do you have on the hot plate right now, Freak?
At the hot plate, currently I have my kind of the traditional literature review. So that's what I'm currently working on for my PhD project. And I'm really thinking of how can I start working and crafting silence into the PhD journeys of other people, because that's one of the groups that I'm thinking about of studying. And the PhD journey for many people is an impactful journey. It's transformational, but also impactful. It impacts the mental health, not always in the best ways. There's a lot of pressures, and I would like to contribute with my research to kind of a practice for PhD candidates that will help them to better deal or better cope with, say, all the pressures and requirements, both internal and external, that they experience.
That's a great mission, and what it means to society going forward is that more people will complete their dissertations and earn the PhD, because for the various doctorates of several kinds, the completion rates are not always that great. And when you know someone who didn't finish, you know that they're loaded with shame. They're not shamed by others. They're just loaded with shame. Yeah. Sometimes brush it off and saying, "Well, I guess I really wasn't as interested in that certification of my intelligence than others thought. But down deep, who doesn't want to finish an advanced study and have all that more reinforcement about the value of what they can think and say and write to others? Everyone wants it. So you think that you're going to come up with some ways to help people design that experience and as they're moving forward in a way that they can keep the stresses down and keep the clarity of purpose in mind? If you can, yes. Yay.
Yeah. I mean, it's ambitious. I don't think I will, of course, come up with the golden solution. I would like to contribute to at least to the insights, and maybe in my work can also at least help the people that I'm working with. Learn better how to have internal dialogues, and then sometimes come with a new position that could create some liberty or some freedom, because I think that's very important. That also as a PhD candidate, but I think basically in life, that you find ways to stay free. And that's why maybe my name is so nice, because if you skip the K, then my name reads free.
Well,
what's in the name?
My name is Fear On. Continue to be anxious.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Fear is my name, but I like free better.
Yes.
Well, I have to ask one more question at least, because I'm watching my time budget. But I've always been curious about what it's like to grow up in, I assume you're born in the Netherlands and stay there and be part of its development, in its future as a nation. Now, that's a big, grandiose question. But first, am I correct that you are a native of the Netherlands?
Yes, I was born and raised in this country, and I lived most of my life in the Netherlands.
Yeah. So while we're all these pushes over the last decades to think globally, to be global citizens, all of that's very important, because many of the worst problems in the world occur in places that need our time and attention. But how do you feel about being part of your nation and its place in the world going forward, and maybe staying there and developing the next generation of thoughtful people? Or do you want to move to New Jersey and here in the States?
Well, I would like to take a sabbatical and maybe go to Esalen in California again. I've been there twice for a work scholar program.
Esalen. Yeah, that's
Esalen,
amazing.
Wonderful place. Yeah. Yes, the Netherlands. I think, on the one hand, I feel Dutch. On the other hand, I feel part of the world.
Good.
Yeah, we have a rich history, but also a complicated history with slavery and our dealings with that. So I think we still need to work on that. We have still some work to do with our past in Indonesia and the way we didn't want to let go of Indonesia, and we started the war, which we called police actions. And at the same time, I think so that is something that we still carry with us, and that we still need to find terms with it all. But at the same time, I feel that we are kind of a small country with kind of an ingenuity. We know how to deal with water. We know how to kind of work together, although also in the Netherlands we have, of course, all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. But I think we have a certain maybe sense of awareness what it is to be a small player in the world. And so be a little like be smaller, but still try to kind of have an impact for the better. I think, at least that's what I, as a Dutch citizen or as a world citizen, would like to do. How can I contribute in my way to a better world? And I already had it when I was a child, and it maybe was dormant a bit during my corporate career, but it reemerged, and I feel also I want to kind of help PhD students, yeah, to have a maybe not easier, but a journey that they can cope with better.
Yeah, that's great causes. What is the Dutch student like these days from your perspective as a teacher? Are they a mix of local and global as well, or are they pulling in their horns?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer, because I teach at the University of Applied Sciences in the east of the Netherlands. It's much more Dutch oriented, whereas a lot of the, say, academic universities in the Netherlands have a much more diverse international student population. I have some of my students who also would like to go abroad to extend their experiences. And we talked about how important it is to have experiences. Mm-hmm. I feel that students these days are in a more difficult situation than I was 40 years ago, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. There's more pressure, I feel. Perfectionism has increased. So the striving for perfectionism has increased. There are more distractions continuously. We had distractions also when I was a student, but not as continuous as it is today. And I think that's one of the difficult things to deal with, the continuous distraction of indeed your phone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Your iPad. It's everywhere.
It is everywhere. Yes. Yes.
Well, that all of us, particularly those of us who are past the teaching phase of our lives, seem to want to talk about what about kids these days, you know, as part of our conversation. And I agree with you that the feedback I get from particularly those still teaching is that there's a tremendous fight for attention that we as teachers have now that we never had to worry about before.
No.
There's a conscious effort, ironically, paradoxically. You're paying tuition money and all the other sacrifices thereto pertaining. And yet when they arrive in the classroom, they don't want to be engaged. No. And like, come on, you know, you're paying for this, you know, pay attention. Mm-hmm. I've got something here. And this is some paraphrasing conversations I had. I went to our teaching conference, Organization Behavior Teaching Conference, our 50th anniversary for the Society for Teaching Organization Behavior. And I was kind of bopping around, sort of saying to all these young folk, what's your greatest challenge? By and large, every one of them said engagement. Maybe we came off the pandemic and kids got conditioned to online and didn't want to be present in the classroom again. But presence and experience and conversation and all those things that I think light us up is what we need to rekindle somehow in our work.
Yes, and I you refer to the pandemic. I think it started before, because I started teaching in 2012, and I experienced myself somewhere between 2017 and 2019 a turn, a shift, and indeed a stronger need for getting the attention of the students. And I think sometimes as teachers, we need to compete with the Netflix of this world. So these are large corporates with enormous amounts of money that can invest enormous amounts of money into the most fancy, the most captivating programs. And
can't touch it.
And it's difficult to sometimes compete with it. And it's also easy digestible, right? Everything that is offered maybe on all the different media platforms is easy to digest. And learning sometimes requires a struggle with the topic or a struggle with the concept, like, oh, I don't really understand this. Oh, but what does this mean? And I remember when I was a student, I needed to sometimes really for a year struggle with the concept. And then sometimes I still didn't understand it. But if you are kind of fed everything so in easily chewable blocks, then you also want your study material to be offered that way. So I think there are so many developments that make it more difficult for the students and for the teachers as well.
Yeah, I think you were onto something there, which will in some ways inform your study of the PhD learner now and what he and she are coping with now, both as a learner who didn't necessarily get the best learning experience because of they came through that era. And secondly, all these things are bombarding them too, but then that what I learned the hard way about a dissertation was it was a topic I bit off too much than I can chew. And Peter Vail, who was my advisor, said, well, Dave, you know, you've got enough study here that you'll never finish your doctorate. But I said, yeah, but I'm interested in all these connections and this theory, Fred Fiedler theory on leadership, continuate leadership was just out and I want to do this and I want to do that. But my point is that once I found out sort of the nut of what my interest was in that particular subject, it all came together. I brought it together. I synthesized, I integrated, and I wrote out a pretty profound story of what I'd learned. That was a high point. I haven't done much like that since. And that's what you're on to right now. I can't tell you how happy I am. I can tell you, I'm very happy meeting you, Rick, and hearing about what you're doing and hearing what you're intending to mean both in the Netherlands and beyond in the world. Stay in touch with those action research folks. Wow.
I certainly will.
Hillary Bradbury is one of the first people that I connected with and have a podcast episode with. She's amazing, sitting there in Ireland, you know, with that wonderful outlook. Every time I've come across a true action researcher, I know I'm going to have days and weeks of great conversations with them. And if I can pitch in, you know, which I've done from time to time in my projects, transformation is worth it. It does happen. You can transform a team, a community, maybe a company once in a while. There's a little more resistant. But when you see it happening, wow.
Yes.
It's wonderful.
Do we still have time for me to talk about the transformation that I experienced?
Please do. We have time.
Yes. Because you mentioned this, and I've been part of a kind of a movement. It's called Hotel con Corazón. It means hotel with a heart. And we are very much for profit, non for profit. So we've been running a hotel in Nicaragua, and with the profits of the hotel, we've been investing in local educational projects. And we started with working with the local community, and we started working with the teachers and with the parents and with the children. And these were two small schools in a rural area out of Granada, so it was very, very, in a way, poor. And we engaged in all kinds of initiatives. And at a certain moment, after maybe a year into the project, we came back to the schools because we were visiting the schools very often, but I hadn't been back to the schools for a year. And I saw that the parents had taken the initiative to restore the fence around the school. And that for me was a sign, okay, we are onto something.
There you go.
They are kind of retaking ownership of their school. They're taking the ownership of their, and it was so wonderful to see that, you know, together we were working, and then we had, of course, initiated it, but then they started to take over, and that for me was a true transformation. And
absolutely.
That was wonderful to see that. And the children, you know, they learned how to read and write. And it was so beautiful. And the project is still going on. We now have a hotel in Mexico, and we're going to build one in Costa Rica, all from the same principle. We build a local presence. We earn money with the hotel operations. And then at this moment, 75% of the profits, we invest then in local educational projects that we co-design and co-create with the community, because it's that is for me what action research also is. co-creation, doing it together. And then if you see things like this happening, then that was truly wonderful and a true transformation.
Well, I'm glad you told me about that. Yeah, here in our community, I worked to help establish a model social enterprise as a philosophy. And then we created legislation in Connecticut, created a status for a company that's for-profit, but also has a public purpose, common good. And of course, there's also over here another categorization of some businesses called benefit corporations that has a similar feel, and they have to put their business practices and their other practices to the test. And I've always taken some hope from that. But I have a really good friend with whom I used to teach, spent many years in Nicaragua as a banker before she went to Harvard and earned her doctorate and so forth. I'll be pleased to tell Sarah Stuckey about this. She probably knows about it. She's very tuned into Nicaragua still. She spent her sabbatical down there a few years back before I left. But what I did learn from her in our conversations over coffee, and she's in the next office down, was about what you said about the children. She said, Dave, you can go into our schools here in New Britain, where the kids come from all kinds of diverse areas, but mainly live in poverty. You can go there. You'll see the same light in an eye of a child when you spend a little time with them and you show them how to solve a problem. And so that's the fundamental of our nature. We show us, help us, but solve a problem, but don't solve it for us.
Exactly.
You see?
Yeah.
So you get those parents, you've shown them that it's a problem that can be solved, but you didn't come in there and build a fence. I give them, you know, $100,000 to do this and that. But you do have a source that you can rely on of funding that's free. I mean, by that, I mean, it's not government money, foundation money, where there's a lot of strings. It's money that's earned through people enjoying themselves at a hotel in Nicaragua, which I understand is quite beautiful. So, wow. Thanks for asking me to take a little more time on this recording, because that's a great story in itself. All the things you've shared are, I hope we can become friends.
I think we are already.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to let you know when this is coming out into the world. I only put one episode out a week, so it'll be sometime in April. And I will definitely want to stay in the network. If you can think of any time to give me a little note saying hello and here's what I'm working on, I'd be thrilled. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. And in a way, you reminded me of Geert Hofstede, a professor I saw when I was a student. I think he was already also in his 80s. And he was still standing on the stage, and he was talking with his son, who was also a researcher. And that image was for me like an aspirational image, like, okay, still being in your 80s and still being active. And now I'm talking with you, and you said you were 81. So this for me is heartwarming, and it is what I believe in and what I think is so important, that in society we keep on valuing the experience of the elder people, and or maybe you still feel very young, but say older of age.
I feel all 81 years right now.
Okay.
But intellectually, no, I'm still like you were when you went into that library with your dad.
Yes.
I'm still that way.
Yes.
I'm still take joy in discovering something that's a little new to me, at least, and then teasing it a little bit. So yeah, keep that going. I also will mention that about 12 or 14 of our episodes in the podcast series were my son and me. Dave's at Johns Hopkins here in Baltimore. His dissertation was titled Social Enaction, ENATION. He Like, I have always been interested in close contact ways that we develop society from the inside out. And he's basically working in their science libraries, supporting the design of studies. He loves this topic, and he'll be listening to this conversation, I'm sure.
Great. Nice.
Okay. How do you say fond farewell in Dutch?
We say tot ziens.
Kok zien?
Tot ziens.
Kok zien.
With a T. T-O-T. Tot ziens.
Ziens. Kok zien.
Tot ziens.
Thank you for listening to the Practice Podcast, conversations probing the nature of practice. If you'd like to hear more, go to Podomatic, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And please consider purchasing our book on practice as a way of being at mylibrary.world. It's a digital book with lots of features that you do not see in a conventional book. So once again, thank you, and I look forward to you listening again. Oh, and one more thing. Please check out our webpage at enactionresearch.info.